Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Companies go bankrupt all the time. All the time. This one, though, it's different.
It's not just any company we're talking about. It's GM.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 1st of June today. It's Monday, and it is great to have you here. We all knew it was coming, General Motors in Chapter 11, so really, that's not the news. Now that GM is in bankruptcy officially, we figured it was worth exploring how it might get out. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott is on the GM story today. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Kai.
Amy, there are a lot of things that need to happen now in this case for it to work out for General Motors. All of them pretty much have to go right, too, don't they?
Pretty much. And we can talk about the things that are in GM's control, like making cars that people want to buy. Analysts say there are some good ones in the pipeline. A replacement for the Chevy Cobalt will be coming within a year. A competitor to the Toyota Yaris is coming. But then, of course, there's a lot that's beyond GM's control. The plan requires U.S. auto sales industry-wide to recover to about $10 million a year just for GM to break even. Right now, those sales are at about $9.3 million. So in addition to making cars people want, GM really needs the economy to come back. And, you know, with plants closing and another 21,000 people losing their jobs, GM's bankruptcy isn't exactly a shot in the arm for the U.S. economy.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about something that GM CEO Fritz Henderson said in his press conference, which followed the president's remarks today. He said, "The thing for us now is speed. Pure, unadulterated speed." Why is it so important that GM do this bankruptcy filing quickly?
Well, of course, the longer a company is in bankruptcy, the more confidence in the company can erode, both from the standpoint of customers and the suppliers that are helping build the cars. And President Obama addressed those issues when he spoke today. In the case of Chrysler, it's set to come out of bankruptcy probably within the next few days, just about a month after it filed.
Keep in mind, many experts said that a quick surgical bankruptcy was impossible. They were wrong. Others predicted that Chrysler's decision to enter bankruptcy would lead to an immediate collapse in consumer confidence that would send car sales over a cliff. They were wrong as well. In fact, Chrysler sold more cars in May than it did in April.
Now, GM is obviously a much bigger company, and its reorganization will be much more complex. But there is a lot of pressure to get out of bankruptcy and really out of government ownership before too much damage is done to GM's brands.
So with car sales at 9.3 million a year in this country, that's not a good thing for the whole auto industry. But there has to be opportunity here for somebody, right?
Right. The obvious beneficiaries are the Japanese automakers that have been making a bigger push in this country, Toyota and Honda, and of course, Nissan. GM's market share is expected to drop from around 20% to more like 12 or 13%. So somebody else is going to snap that up, or maybe a few somebodies. And one of them is Ford. On one hand, Ford won't have had the same opportunity to shed some of its legacy labor and healthcare costs the way that Chrysler and GM will have in court. But analysts say Ford's done a pretty good job of restructuring on its own, and it's making more of the cars that people are excited about. So Ford's in a good position to benefit from any customers that do shy away from Chrysler and GM. And one analyst told me that Ford is expected to surpass GM in sales in the next 12 to 18 months.
And General Motors, of course, the company that spent 70 years as the biggest car company in the world. Amy Scott in New York for us. Thanks, Amy.
All right, you're welcome.
On any other day, the Treasury Secretary getting laughed at in China would have been right up at the top of this radio program. GM, though, has pushed Timothy Geithner's trip to Beijing a little bit lower, and we'll get there in a bit. Should you have been in the mood for some penny stock trading today, could have bought shares of GM for a buck at one point on the New York Stock Exchange. Why, though, is another question. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In his remarks at the White House today, President Obama reminded us exactly how much skin we've all got in General Motors right now. Taxpayers own 60% of the company in return for $50 billion in government aid. Commentator Robert Reich asks what we're getting for our money.
You and I and other taxpayers now own what was once the largest company on Earth. But it's difficult to find a public purpose behind the biggest industrial bailout in history. The goal can't be to preserve jobs because the Treasury has been telling GM to slim down, and the company plans to shut 11 factories and lay off 21,000 workers. If the goal is a much smaller and leaner GM that might be profitable one day, that's something the private sector is better able to do than government, through workouts or bankruptcies, and there's no reason for public involvement. If the goal is to create a prototype for a fuel-efficient car of the future, Congress has already appropriated money for that, and the Treasury says it doesn't want to tell the new GM what to produce anyway. If the goal is to repay the public, there's no point in putting up the public's money to begin with. So why exactly are we doing this? Maybe because the sudden dissolution of an American icon like GM would be a blow to the American psyche, further eroding confidence during this deep recession. Yet under normal bankruptcy, the GM brand would likely live on, and GM's other valuable pieces would be bought up. Over the next decade or so, GM, as we've known it, will likely disappear in any event. The government's huge stake in it merely slows down this process. Which I think is the point. The government is investing some $60 billion in GM in order to slow its demise and thereby give its workers, suppliers, dealers, and the communities that depend on it more time to adjust. But if the purpose is to help the Midwest adapt to industrial decline, investing that much money in GM seems an inefficient way to accomplish it. Wouldn't it be better to use the money to convert GM and other declining manufacturing companies into producing what America needs, such as light rail systems and new energy-efficient materials, and training laid-off auto workers for the technician jobs of the future?
As Bob said, 50 years ago, General Motors was the biggest industrial corporation on the planet. It was, in its day, considered a model of how to run a global enterprise. What was good for the country really was good for General Motors and vice versa. But as to how the company finds itself in bankruptcy today, historian and commentator John Steele Gordon says the answer lies in what was not good for GM or for the country.
Between the end of World War II and the early 1970s, the big three automakers had a cartel in the American market. Except for a few niche players like British Sports Cars and the Volkswagen Beetle, they had it to themselves. 50% for GM, 30% for Ford, 15% for Chrysler. Instead of competing for market share with better design, lower prices, or technical innovation, they rested on their laurels and split the guaranteed profits with the United Auto Workers, who commanded ever more generous wages and benefits. The big three, like all monopolists, became fat, dumb, lazy, and incredibly bureaucratic. When the price of oil shot up in 1973 and Japanese cars that were better designed, better built, and better looking invaded the American market, the big three were caught utterly flat-footed. They have been trying unsuccessfully to adapt to the new market conditions ever since, proof that a corporate culture is a very, very hard thing to change. The current recession proved the final straw. So is GM's bankruptcy the end of American industrial might? Hardly. American manufacturing is orders of magnitude more productive than it was 50 years ago. So manufacturing output in the last 30 years has more than doubled, even while the number of manufacturing jobs has been declining sharply, as it has everywhere in the industrial world, even China. Rather, it is simply an example of the creative destruction that is the hallmark of capitalist systems. Of the 30 members of the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1959, exactly four are still in the index, as General Motors got the boot this morning. AT&T, another component, is an utterly different company today than it was then. Many of the biggest companies on today's list, Intel, Walmart, Microsoft, did not even exist 50 years ago. So GM's bankruptcy is not the end of industrial America, only the end of mid-20th century industrial America. Frankly, it's about time.
That was economic historian John Steele Gordon there. Earlier, we heard from Robert Reich. He teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. We would like to hear from you no matter where you are. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Last Friday, we did a quick economic progress report to see whether we'd hit bottom. Not yet was the answer for the most part. But confidence is returning in dribs and drabs. The markets have started ticking back up. Take today and what will be the really happy music for one perfect example. But at the risk of raining on some parades, behavioral economist Dan Ariely is back to tell us how that might not be such a good thing after all. Hey, Dan, good to talk to you again.
Same here.
You know, things don't look quite as bad in the stock market as they did the last time we spoke, but actually improvement, according to you, may not be such a good thing?
Well, first of all, it's very hard to understand why the market went so low and what happened in the last month that it have been going up in terms of fundamental. But the problem is that much of the time when we are called into action, it's not based on rationality, it's based on emotions. And right now, emotions are not as bad, and because of that, we're unlikely to take substantial action to improve the markets.
Well, so do emotions not work as well on the way up as they do on the way down?
They work against changes, right? Yeah. So right now you're saying, well, I know how bad things would be. I don't want to experience it again. I just experience it. And I know that if we'll shake Wall Street up, stock value would go down because everybody would panic again. And because of that, we're not going to go in. We're not going to change all the fundamental things we now know are wrong.
Let me ask you about this badly designed market. Isn't the stock market reasonably efficient? If you want to buy something, you go in, you discover the price, you pay it, and then you're done. And the same way on the sell side. Is that not true?
No, it's not. It's not true in many ways. You know, the economic theory basically tells us the free markets can work fantastically, but under very, very small set of circumstances. And it's, I think, clear to all of us that right now these circumstances don't hold in the market. So, you know, we talked a lot about cheating in the past, mm-hmm. but think about the following. You have individuals who are bankers who have really pervasive incentives where they can make a lot of money, where their investors make money, and they don't lose when their investors lose. What does that mean? It means that they have a huge incentive to take extra risk. Mm. What about the rating agencies? They've been basically giving people AAAs when they shouldn't have gotten AAAs. Me as a consumer, I can't go and read everything and understand everything and basically get my own reputation rating, credit ratings. So I trust these entities. They've clearly failed us.
For those who are in the markets, though, how do you separate your short-term interest of wanting a gain, wanting a return, with the more widely desirable goal of long-term increases in market value?
This is very tough, and I think this is the reason why we're not really taking any action right now. Now, because it's emotional, we're not going to do it. We personally, for individuals, it's very hard to go now and protest when the stock market is doing slightly better and start creating local activity groups that will basically try to persuade the government to do something to regulate the market. Mm. And because of that, it's unlikely that the government will get into action and try to create substantial regulations. So I'm actually very worried about this. And I think in many ways it would have been better for us as a society in the long term if the stock market didn't recover and if we would have had a continuous bad situation for another 6 months. It would have been painful 6 months, but 3, 4, 5 years from now, it would have been in a better situation if that was the case.
Who knows, though, Dan? It may be lousy for another 6 months, and then you'd get your wish, right?
It's, you know, I don't want that this will happen, and then people would say, you know, oh, thank
you. It was that Ariely guy on Marketplace, man. It was his fault.
That's right.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on why we do what we do is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, stumping for votes in Sweden.
My name is Christian Engström. I'm the vice chairman of the Pirate Party, and I'm the top candidate for the European Parliament elections.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors really took GM's bankruptcy in stride today, and encouraging news on manufacturing helped kickstart the Dow Industrials. It rose 221 points, about 2 2/3%, finished at 8,721. The NASDAQ gained 54 points, more than 3%, closed at 1828. The S&P 500 climbed 23 points, roughly 2 2/3%, ended the day at 942. Wall Street, as I mentioned, seemed to welcome GM's journey into Chapter 11. Shares of the automaker finished up about 9%. The NYSE, though, will stop trading that stock tomorrow. Meantime, rival Ford appeared to benefit. Shares were up 6 2/3%. Shares of airplane maker Boeing flew more than 6% higher today. Aluminum giant Alcoa regained some lost luster as well. Its stock closed up 6 2/3%. Major retailers cashed in on news consumers could be ready to open their wallets again. Shares of Macy's rang up more than 15%. Rival Nordstrom's was up 14%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on pending home sales for April. Some regularly scheduled news from the auto industry. Automakers report sales figures for May. And focusing on keeping those cars and other surface transportation moving, the Intelligent Transportation Society of America continues its annual meeting. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Timothy Geithner was in Beijing today. The Treasury Secretary is in China for consultations with America's largest lenders. He tried to assure them that their huge investments in U.S. debt on the order of $1 trillion or more are safe. Chinese leaders have been openly squeamish lately about Washington's ballooning deficits and the instability of the U.S. economy. And Geithner's message today that the Obama administration can cut its debt and save the U.S. banking and auto industries all at the same time was met with some skepticism, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
When Secretary Geithner insisted to a Peking University student that China doesn't need to worry about the safety of its U.S. investments, the audience laughed. Donald Strassheim of Strassheim Global Advisors travels frequently to China and isn't surprised by that reaction.
We have no leverage with them as far as I can tell. Most recent trips I've been there, it's all been skepticism and nervousness about our markets, our economy, our economic management, which is understandable. China is going to listen politely, but go their own way.
But China won't get very far without the U.S., says Greg Mastel, a trade policy advisor to the Washington law firm of Akin Gump.
We have as much influence over them in a sense that we are literally too big to fail from China's perspective. So they'd be among the world's biggest losers if the U.S. economy went in the tank. Not to mention that we're the largest market for Chinese goods, so there are a lot of toys and games that wouldn't find a consumer if there weren't for the U.S.
Geithner told China's leaders they can help the U.S. recover by reducing cheap exports and promoting domestic consumption. That would increase demand for more U.S. exports as well, and that in turn could balance the lopsided trade between the two countries. But Strassheim says China, just like the U.S. and every other country, will continue to keep its currency cheap to boost its own exports. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Secretary Geithner probably had all of his meals taken care of at official banquets, I'd guess. But in the rest of China, food safety is a serious issue. Today, Beijing rolled out a new food safety law. It's meant to address the various scandals that have hit that country's food supply the past couple of years. Pet food, toothpaste, cold medicines, and most recently, tainted infant formula that killed at least 6 Chinese babies. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports that the law looks good on paper, but there are some doubts about how effectively it's going to be implemented.
Beijing knows it has a bad rap as an exporter. So, cue the food safety law. This is part of China's rebranding. Zhang Bing is with consultancy A.T. Kearney.
China has been sending a very bad message in terms of the product qualities, and that has had an impact on the food-related export for China.
The law creates safety and recall standards for food makers. It tells them to list all additives, and it imposes harsh fines for violators. But in China, the devil is in the enforcement. Sure, the central government's for it, but Penn Law professor Jacques DeLille wonders about the local level.
There are going to be local interests that cut against enforcing it. For instance, shutting down local producers can have an adverse effect on the local economy, and that's something the local officials worry a great deal about.
China's a big place with hundreds of thousands of teeny tiny food processors, almost impossible to monitor. Still, in the long run, the law does signal Beijing is serious about food safety. And the emerging middle class here demands quality nosh, so things eventually may get better. Shanghai lawyer Mark Schaub says in any event, things weren't that bad here to begin with.
The only time I've ever been sick from eating anything in China was eating a Christmas cake at a five-star hotel about 15 years ago. It's not like everything is tainted here.
The Mandarins in Beijing hope the new food law echoes that message, and they're praying they don't have another safety scandal. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One of the reasons traders on Wall Street shook off the news about General Motors today, and shake it off they did, was a report that Americans are saving again. We learned this morning that the savings rate in this country is now the highest it's been in 14 years. And what's called the savings level, that's all of our little piggy banks combined, hasn't been this high since January 1959. Jill Barshay reports now on the new frugality.
Until a year ago, Americans were adding nothing, zero, to their collective piggy banks. But today, the Commerce Department said, as of April, they're socking away almost 6 cents for every dollar of income. Not quite the 30% savings rate in China, but Bill Gale, an economist at the Brookings Institution, says it's a start.
We are suddenly a nation of scared and realistic people. People cut back on their consumption when they realize they are overcommitted or living above their means.
But Stephen Whiting, an economist at Citigroup, doesn't think Americans are suddenly super thrifty. He says a few things pushed up the savings rate, like the April tax cuts and our gas bills.
Just the lower cost of gasoline has resulted in roughly a $200 billion drop in what people would spend.
But the biggest savers may be the wealthy, who've taken big hits to their investment portfolios. The Brookings Institution's Gale says the collapse in luxury shopping may explain a big chunk of this new American thrift. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Jill mentioned lower gas prices is a big factor in that April savings report. I fear the May and June numbers won't be quite so rosy. Crude closed up more than 3% today, $68.58 a barrel. Gas at the pump rose 45 cents from the beginning to the end of May. Napster is celebrating its 10th anniversary today. Back in June of 1999, it was the first really consumer-friendly music-sharing website out there. That quickly made it very unfriendly for record companies. The music industry sued for copyright violation, then won. So Napster eventually went mainstream. It's part of Best Buy now. But the company's buccaneering spirit lives on. A Swedish political party that wants to restrict copyright protections is attracting a lot of support ahead of this weekend's European elections. From Stockholm, Sweden, Brett Neely reports.
Meet the pirate captain.
My name is Christian Engström. I'm the vice chairman of the Pirate Party, and I'm the top candidate for the European Parliament elections.
The 49-year-old IT consultant doesn't have an eye patch or a wooden leg. His party's logo is a black flag. But the only sign of Engström's pirate tendencies is a discreet lapel pin on his blazer in the shape of a P. For a pirate, his message is peaceful.
We're basically a civil rights party.
In this case, online civil rights. The Pirate Party says music and movies should be freely shared on the web, copyright law should be rewritten, and the current patent system scrapped. Technology activists founded the party in 2006. At the time, the government tried to shut down a popular file-sharing website called the Pirate Bay, which is used by millions of downloaders across the world. In the center of Stockholm, members of the Pirate Party hand out pamphlets and flyers. Robert Myborg, a young party member, says the government went too far when it tried to close the Pirate Bay.
It's very popular in Sweden. That's why there became such a uproar when the police did this to the Pirate Bay.
There's no formal relation between the website and the Pirate Party, though many members do use it. Myborg and other activists aren't just worried about the website. They're also concerned about other technology issues, like a 2008 law that lets the government tap internet connections without a warrant. Candidate Engström says the law inhibits online communications.
I mean, what's the point in having freedom of speech if it applies everywhere except on the internet? And the internet is the only platform that's being used.
In April, the Swedish government convicted the Pirate Bay's founders of violating copyright laws and sentenced them to prison. After the trial, tens of thousands of Swedes joined the Pirate Party, making it the country's third largest with more than 46,000 members. The core supporters are often young men with backgrounds in technology.
These are more like the kind of guys that run your office help desk.
Per Gudmundsson is an editorial writer for the newspaper Svenska Dagbladet. He says these nerds were shut out of the political debate by the establishment and have used the web to build a new kind of political movement.
The traditional parties haven't really been that good in implementing those new social web techniques that the Pirate Party has mastered.
Recent opinion polls show the party getting as much as 8% of the vote in Sweden, enough to win at least one seat in the European Parliament in Brussels, where copyright and telecoms policy is set for the whole of Europe. And the message is spreading to other parts of the continent. There are now registered pirate parties in several other EU countries, including Germany, Spain, and Poland. In Stockholm, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, picking up on something John Steele Gordon mentioned up at the top of the broadcast, General Motors is on its way out of the Dow Industrials. This morning, both GM and Citigroup were given the heave-ho. They will be replaced as of next Monday with Travelers, the insurance company that used to be part of Citigroup, and Cisco Systems, the computer networking company. If by some chance you're wondering right now why GM and Citi weren't replaced earlier, given how those stocks have been doing, well, that's exactly the question we put earlier today to John Prestbow. He's the executive director of Dow Jones Indexes.
Their great declines in price, both of them, are part of the bear market. That's what makes it a bear.
Oh, so that's what makes it a bear. It's nice to have that cleared up, don't you think? That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 221 points, 2.67%. The NASDAQ bumped up 54 points, more than 3%. The S&P 500 rose 23 points, about 2.67%. GM bankruptcy? What GM bankruptcy? Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, on the lookout for bling and the bad guys.
It's getting into Big Brother, really, isn't it? They can just turn it around on, oh, she's got a lot of bling, he's got a lot of bling. They must be loaded with cash.
That's too much bling. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.